Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulis. This is an amazing podcast, really, the best. You're gonna love it, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulis. Some things will never change. That's just the way it is. Ah, but don't you believe them?
Said, hey, little boy, you can't go where the others go. So, welcome to episode 16 of the Security Perimeter Podcast, and today's guest is Dr. Kim Nossel from Queen's University in Canada. Kim is a specialist on Canadian foreign policy. In fact, he's considered one of the fathers of the study of Canadian foreign policy. And when I was a young undergraduate student studying political science and international relations in Canada, when I took my first course on Canadian foreign policy, Kim's textbook on Canadian foreign policy was required reading. And Kim today is going to be speaking to us about the Canada-Mexico relationship with Trump in the middle of all of this, how things are going, where things might go in terms of NAFTA, etc., a whole bunch of other issues. It's going to be a very, very interesting discussion. So, Kim, thank you very, very much for being with us here today on the Security Perimeter Podcast.
Oh, it's great to be here, Saki. Thanks so much for having me.
Kim, the last few weeks in Mexico have gotten particularly polemic. Well, actually, since Trump has come into power. Mexicans are in panic about his election, his comments about NAFTA, his comments about immigrants, his policies with respect to immigrants in the undocumented immigrants in the United States. I mean, there's a whole series of things that most of the listeners and including yourself would know that are going on here in Mexico. The reaction by the Mexican government has been quite harsh. Peña Nieto, the president, has canceled a scheduled meeting with President Trump. And both sides have kind of ratcheted up the hostility. You know, it's gotten, not enemies, so to speak, but we're certainly not as friendly as we used to be. And this sense that Mexico and Canada were Mexico and the U.S. rather were moving towards some kind of post-friendship situation, maybe even an alliance, doesn't seem to be much on the table anymore. Whereas on the case of Canada and the United States, seems to me to be a completely different story. Now, I wanted you to talk a little bit about what the Trudeau government has done in the last couple of months to manage that relationship, because a lot of Mexicans are actually looking at the case of Canada and saying, how the heck did Justin Trudeau pull that off? To the point that Trump actually mentioned Trudeau, I think, a couple of times in his address to Congress last week. So, I mean, how do you see that? Do you see Trudeau handling this Trump situation well? Or would you rather there be a more, I don't know, less of an attempt to be friendly with the Trump administration?
Well, first of all, I think what we've got to do is to recognize that Canada and the United States and Canada and Mexico have fundamentally different relations in the sense that Mexico, along with China, has been front and center, as you and all other Mexicans know full well, has been front and center of Trump's economic nationalist America First policies. Mexico has been accused of all manner of problematic ways of dealing with the United States, along with China, and so that the Mexicans became, as everyone knows, one of the primary targets of Mr. Trump. And when combined with the xenophobic and anti-immigrant part of that program, the idea of building this great wall, which of course is very central to Mr. Trump's appeal to a particular segment of the American population, means that the situation with Mexico was fundamentally different than that with Canada. Mm-hmm. Not only does Canada have a very different trade profile with the United States than Mexico does, in the sense that, first of all, we don't have that much of a surplus in merchandise trade with the United States, but also many of the jobs that have been leaving the United States over the course of the last 30 years tend not to have come north, and so that when Trump looks at his world through his particular eyes, Canada is in a very different situation, and that's why, for example, Canada has never had the same kind of criticisms chucked at it by Trump and his advisors that Mexico has. So that is that's the first thing that one has to recognize, that in Trump's eyes, Canada is not like Mexico. Mm-hmm. And so that, for example, when Justin Trudeau goes to the White House for his meeting with Mr. Trump, the Trump administration's perspective is, not a big problem. NAFTA's not that big a problem with you guys. All we'll have to do is do a couple of little tweaks. Mm-hmm. So when you look at how the Trudeau government has dealt with the Trump administration, you have to begin with the reality that Mr. Trump has a very different perception of Canada, or so it would appear, than he does of Mexico. Now, that having been said, there's absolutely no doubt that the Trudeau government has, from the very first indicator in November with Trump's election, has moved very carefully to try and ensure that Canada would remain on Trump's and the Trump White House's good side. And this is done in a whole number of ways. The very first indicator was the way in which Mr. Trudeau shuffled his cabinet. Canada's foreign minister at the time, Stéphane Dion, was shuffled out of that role. Mm-hmm. And Chrystia Freeland, our trade minister, was put in instead. And that was not only a symbolic move, but it was also a very practical move, in the sense that Mr. Dion had a reputation for being fairly inflexible on certain policy issues, and the concern was that he just simply would not have fitted well with the folks in the Trump White House.
Sorry to cut you off. The Mexicans did the same thing. The foreign ministers were changed, and the foreign minister that was put in was this guy. His name is Videgaray, his last name. And apparently he has a close personal relationship with the son-in-law, Jared Kushner.
Right.
Yep. So and that was also I obviously specifically designed to put somebody in the role that may have some an inside track with the Trump administration. But sorry,
exactly.
Sorry to cut you off. Yeah.
No, but And that dynamic was exactly the same, and so that when Mr. Trudeau went to Washington for his meeting with the Trump White House, in a sense, the Trudeau government's ducks were all lined up in a particular row. Mr. Trudeau and his advisors were very careful to ensure that the things that they did in Washington, essentially appealed to Mr. Trump and his particular personality. So that, for example, one of the things that Mr. Trudeau did was to present Mr. Trump with a picture of Trump as a much younger man, with Mr. Trudeau's father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, at a dinner in New York in the 1970s. I mean, that kind of very little thing was essentially designed to try and ensure that these two leaders, who are so fundamentally different, it's not funny, could in fact get on.
And obviously that wasn't by mistake, right? The picture, I mean, that was actually planned out.
Oh, absolutely not. It was very carefully planned out.
Well, I also heard that the handshake was I read on the news that the actual handshake that Trudeau gave Trump was designed to, you know, to show friendship and equality and so forth. Is that the case?
Well, in fact, if you look carefully at the video, what Mr. Trudeau did was, when he went to shake Mr. Trump's hand, it was quite clear that what he didn't want to do was to have what happened to some other leaders and other figures, that when Mr. Trump shakes their hand, he basically pulls you in, and he has a very strange handshake. What Mr. Trudeau did was to extend his left arm to Mr. Trump's shoulder when he shook his hand, to prevent from being pulled in.
Right, which is a sign of dominance, right? I mean, to pull somebody in. Apparently.
Well, you can interpret. You can give it that kind of psychological interpretation. Yeah. Certainly, it would appear as though Mr. Trudeau knew what he was getting into.
Now, so do you actually think that they sat there for a couple of hours and prepped him on how to actually shake his hand with Trump? I mean, was that part of
I don't know, but would it surprise me if every bit of this particular visit wasn't very carefully choreographed and practiced beforehand? Absolutely not. I mean, as for Mexico, it's exactly the same for Canada. That relationship is a crucial relationship, and so that I would anticipate that there was some very careful planning that went into even something small like the handshake. Much more important, of course, was Mr. Trudeau's roping in of Ivanka Trump,
right,
in the creation of a Canada-United States panel on women in business, and basically, if you look at the pictures of Ivanka Trump and Justin Trudeau together, it's quite clear that there is some connection there, and so that. When subsequently, just last week, Mr. Trudeau goes to New York to open or to be at a play in New York about how the good folks of Gander, Newfoundland assisted passengers flying on 9/11, he invited Ivanka Trump along to the performance. Now, he also invited her father, Mr. Trump, but Mr. Trump chose not to attend. But what is being called in Canada daughter diplomacy is likewise designed to ensure that the relationship at least gets off on a better foot than the relationship with, for example, the Mexican president and with the Australian prime minister and with the French president. In short, the idea was to try and ensure that the relationship with the White House right from the outset was as smooth as possible.
But the Mexican president canceled his visit to Washington after Trump said that he was going to build a wall, a nice wall,
yes,
with nice doors, but and that the Mexicans would pay for it.
Would pay for it, yes.
Yeah. My reaction, I thought that was an overreaction on the part of the Mexicans. I had at that time I was speaking to some policymakers or immediately afterwards, and I said what Peña Nieto should have done, he should have said, you know what, I've suddenly come down with a cold, hint, but I'm going to send my foreign minister instead in order to, you know, show that we didn't like the comment, but at the same time demonstrate that the relationship is quite important. Do you think, from your perspective, do you think the Mexican reaction is an overreaction, or do you think it's spot on?
No, I actually disagree with you quite considerably on this. I think that the Mexican reaction was not only entirely appropriate, but what, you know, essentially this administration is, because it's such a shambolic administration that has a really hard time focusing and getting stuff done, that I actually think that it makes no sense at all to suck up to the White House in such a circumstance as when the president engages in that kind of baiting in this case the Mexicans. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Mr. Trump knows that he spent the entire year 2016 revving up his supporters with the notion that Mexico would pay for the wall. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, my own view is that if you're the president of Mexico, if you're the government of Mexico, there's no way that you can pretend that that's okay. That, mm-hmm, you know, we'll come down with a diplomatic flu and we'll send someone less. No, I think you've got to push back at this administration. Mm-hmm. And let me say that in the case of the Trudeau government, I mean, the Trudeau government, in my view, has played it very smart, in the sense that Trump so far has given Canadians and Canada and the Canadian government, mm-hmm, no particular reason to respond in a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
My own view is that day will come that this administration, because it is so xenophobic, because it is so racist, because it is so destructive of the global order, and because it is so careless about its friends and its allies, as evident, for example, in the way in which the president treated Angela Merkel last week, the way in which president treated Malcolm Turnbull, the Prime Minister of Australia, when he yelled at him on the phone and then hung up rudely. Mm-hmm. This is a president who truly doesn't care about friends and allies, and that's quite clear. And so I have no doubt at all that there will come a point when Mr. Trump will look at some aspect of the Canadian-American relationship, will pull some stupid stunt like he pulled with the Mexican wall, and the Canadian government is going to have to basically respond, and then we'll see. We'll see whether or not the government of Canada will respond by essentially trying to sweep it under the rug. But let's face it, the same calculus that Peña Nieto used, and that is, how are Mexicans, ordinary Mexicans, going to respond to this? That same calculus is going to have to be in Mr. Trudeau's mind too. How will ordinary Canadians respond to this?
Yeah, there was a rally effect here immediately after Peña Nieto decided that he wasn't going to go to Washington for the visit. What do you think of NAFTA? What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, now, this is a really good question, because it's quite clear that Trump and most importantly, his trade advisors, not only Wilbur Ross, but also Peter Navarro, essentially see NAFTA as one of the key sources of all of America's supposed ills. And so that, you know, if you listen to Mr. Ross, then there's going to be a significant renegotiation of NAFTA, and that is going to be a large question about how that renegotiation is actually performed. And of course, most importantly, what will be the various subject areas? Let's put it that way.
The way I see it, there's a few scenarios. Scenario one, which I think both Mexico and Canada would love, would be a tweaking where a three-way tweaking where something is given up, maybe on labor or something like that, and Trump can go back and say, look, you know what, I got a new deal on NAFTA. That's option number one. Option number two is something much more extensive that may or may not involve Mexico. That's the one that a lot of Mexicans are worried about. Do you think that that's a possibility, or do you think the first option is more likely?
Well,
or is there a third option out there that I haven't thought of?
I don't know whether there's a third option right now, but let's put it this way. Mr. Trump, when he talks to Canadians, talks about tweaking NAFTA. When he talks to Mexicans, he basically is quite prepared to think about simply walking away from NAFTA altogether. And so the question is, what's actually going to happen? And like many aspects of policy with this administration, we actually don't know. Because Mr. Ross, Wilbur Ross, his position is, this is going to be much more than a tweak. And his position to the Canadians is, get ready. Because we're going to have a serious negotiation. The real question is whether or not that negotiation is going to occur in a trilateral mode, or whether the Americans are going to essentially embrace a kind of hub and spoke situation where they're going to do one set of negotiations with the Canadians and another set of negotiations with the Mexicans.
That's what the Mexicans are worried about, and which leads me to another question. Mexicans are concerned about how Canada seems to have been reacting vis-a-vis Trump and Mexico.
In the sense that
it looks like Canada's kind of throwing Mexico under the bus, so to speak, right? The logic behind that, obviously, is it's in Canada's interest, and that's what the Canadian ambassador here has said. Do you think there's
what has the Canadian ambassador in Mexico said about this?
Yeah, the Canadian ambassador has said that, look, we have friends and we have interests. Mexico is a friend. The United States is an interest. And our interests will always come before our friends. It was kind of blunt.
I was just going to say, was he that blunt?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But do you think it's possible that Canada might be in a situation where it has to throw Mexico under the bus, so to speak?
Well, let's put it this way: there is a debate in Canada about precisely how to conceive of Mexico as a friend and the United States as an interest, and what the view that you attribute to the Canadian ambassador in Mexico City represents one side of that debate. There is the other side, and the other side is that Canada should not and will not throw Mexico under the bus by recognizing that fundamental difference in perception that I began our discussion with, taking advantage of the fact that Canada is seen in a much more friendly light than Mexico. There is a view, and certainly our new foreign minister, Ms. Freeland, has been quite explicit about promising that that Canada is not about to throw Mexico under the bus.
Yeah, we are getting confusing signals out of Ottawa, or at least out of Mexico City and Ottawa, rather, as to what Canada's position is. Kim, go ahead.
No, and I was just going to say that there's the Freeland position is backed up by such folks as former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. I mean, Mulroney, who of course was the Prime Minister when the Mexicans and Americans started talking about their free trade negotiation. It was at Mulroney's push and initiative that two-way trade negotiation became a trilateral negotiation. I mean, Mulroney is quite clearly on the record. He said something like that abandoning Mexico in order to maximize our relationship with the United States is something that only a loser would do.
That's interesting. I was going to say, why would that? How could that be in Canada's interests? I'm not saying I'm defending the Canadian ambassador in Mexico, but why would it be in Canada's interest to insist that this be trilateral, whatever is going to happen, be it a minor tweaking or a major overhaul?
Well, I couldn't really speak for the government here, but in my estimation, one of the reasons why is that NAFTA as an agreement is a trilateral agreement, and thus unless you want to renounce the entire agreement and start again, then if you want to renegotiate a trilateral agreement, then you have to have all the partners at the table. That you can't do a divide and conquer approach, a hub and spoke approach, unless you want to go back to the beginning, renounce the treaty, and start again bilaterally. So that from a purely legal perspective, I would not want, if I were the Canadians, to say, oh yeah, fine, let's just throw the legalities out. Mm-hmm. The second reason has to do with the nature, in my view, the nature of politics with this new administration in Washington, and that is that Canada, it seems to me, has a real interest in communicating to everyone, to the Americans, to the Mexicans, but also to others in the international system, that Canada is going to remain by its friends.
It's a blunt question, Kim. What's the view in Canada of Mexico? I mean, how does the Canadian government see Mexico, especially in the last 10 years or so, with the increased violence and the horror stories that are all over the news whenever something happens here? Is there a sense in Ottawa that trilateralism in that sense has failed, that North America as a region is not going to work because the Mexican element is just too unstable and too fragile and too violent, or does Canada really see Mexico, like you just mentioned a few moments ago, a country that Canada wants to work with, needs to work with in the context of North America?
But you see, here's the thing with Canadian views of Mexico. The first thing is to recognize that there is a difference between economic interests and a calculation of Mexico's supreme importance in the growth of a truly North American economy. And so from that point of view, there's a recognition of the centrality of Mexico to those international or trilateral value chains that flow across borders and that have been so very good for all three of our countries.
But I mean, there's so little trade between Canada and Mexico,
though. That's not the point. The point isn't to want to maximize trade between us and Mexico. Mm-hmm. On the contrary, what I think that the Canadian position is that it's the integration of Mexico into the American economy and vice versa, mm-hmm. And the integration of Canada in the American economy and vice versa, mm-hmm. That means that the trilateral experiment that was embraced in the early 1990s must be, first of all, it has been a success, and that is something that needs to be stressed far more. Mr. Trump's characterization of NAFTA as having been a disaster for the United States, of having produced this so-called American carnage, is just so far away from the characterization of reality
nonsense. It is
nonsense. Here, though, is the important thing, that and this is where I think it really is important to recognize that when Trump talks about American carnage, he is in fact talking to a group of Americans who have not done well out of NAFTA. Or out of the evolution of the American economy in the last 25 years, not only because of Mexico and China, but also because of automation. But also, and this is something that foreigners don't stress enough, and that is that one of the reasons why there were so many Americans who feel hard done by as a consequence of the shift in the American economy over the last 25 years, one of the reasons is that the United States, as an advanced capitalist country, has such a truly crummy social welfare system. Mm-hmm. The way in which the United States government, the state, at both the federal and state levels, the incapacity of the state to deal humanely with American citizens who are not doing well, that is something that Americans, of course, need to recognize. But it also is something that should be pushed back at this administration to get them to recognize that it is true that not every American has done well in the way that the United States, in the aggregate, has done well out of NAFTA. But all of that by mm-hmm. way of saying that for Canada, there's a recognition that NAFTA has been excellent for us, but it's also been excellent for the United States and Mexico, and for that reason alone, needs to be perpetuated. Now, that's a different question entirely to the one that you ask about, and that is what kind of the view of Mexico is in the Canadian government. Because there's no doubt that Canadian officials recognize that there are huge differences between Canadians and Mexicans in terms of culture, in terms of foreign policy, in terms of the closeness and proximity to each other. And in that sense, I don't think that there's an enthusiasm in Ottawa for example, developing a hugely close relationship with Mexico, of the sort that, let's say, for example, Canadians have with Australians, mm-hmm. Or with Brits, mm-hmm. Or with the French. Mm-hmm. At the same time,
because of these differences that you just mentioned, because of the
cultural differences and the distance that those cultural differences encourage, and so that there's that element. There also is the element, and this is something that some Canadian officials have been quite explicit about, and that is that Canadians feel that they have a privileged relationship with the United States, mm-hmm. While they're quite happy to have the United States and Mexico in the economic sphere, there are other elements in the bilateral relationship with the United States where essentially the Canadians just want to be with the Americans by themselves, and thus have no difficulty at all in essentially shunting Mexican officials to one side in that respect.
There was a story the other day, I think it was in the Post, that the number of refugees, Mexican refugees, trying to get into the United States has tripled over the last year. Since the visa was taken away, do you see the visa coming back?
Refugee claims in Canada, not yes. the United States.
Right. Yeah. Refugee. Canada. Yeah. Mexican refugee claimants in Canada has tripled over the same period last year.
Well, let's put it this way. I mean, the Mexican visa issue that was introduced by the Harper administration in 2009 has been something that has just absolutely clouded the relationship in the nastiest possible way, and the way in which it was done was guaranteed to put a very nasty thorn in that relationship. Now, I mean, the reality is that visa.
But there were, over 50% of refugee claimants were coming from Mexico. Something was going on.
Absolutely, and we know what was going on. It was essentially a very carefully orchestrated.
Sorry.
No problem. Yeah. It was a very carefully orchestrated campaign by snakeheads to move Mexicans into Canada and to take advantage of Canada's generosity and generous approach to refugees. I mean, the Canadian ambassador to Mexico told me that there were some Aeromexico flights landing in Vancouver, you know, where 118 out of 120 passengers were in fact refugee claimants. And look, you know, because of Canada's generous approach to refugees, the Canadian government, liberal or conservative, tends to have to play a great game of whack-a-mole when it comes to refugees. You know, when Hungarian Roma start being moved to Canada by people smugglers, then all of a sudden the Canadian government imposes a visa, and then all of a sudden, because it's impossible, that business dries up. When it happens in Mexico, Canada imposes a visa, the market dries up. You lift the visa, the market comes back, and so it's not entirely clear how the Canadian government is going to deal with the resurgence of Mexican refugee claimants in Canada.
Well, why 40,000 Syrian refugees and not from a war-torn zone, as opposed to 40,000 Mexican refugees who, from the north of the country, who are literally experiencing pretty much the same kind of situation?
And a lot of that, I think, has to do with context. The Syrian situation was painted in a very different way than in the Mexican case, and so that, you know, many Canadians, I think, when they think of Mexico, they don't think of Mexico or parts of Mexico as being essentially in a war zone. They have a sense that there is a problem with violence in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Many Canadians who've been tourists in Mexico are aware of sort of some of the inequalities that they themselves have seen and experienced mm-hmm. in Mexico. But I think that the Syrian war is one that is capable of being sort of portrayed in Canada in a fundamentally different way, which is why I think that there was a general willingness to welcome Syrian refugees in a way that probably would not be the same case with refugees from Mexico.
Fair enough. That seems to make sense. Okay, let me ask you, this is the last question, Kim, so you're almost off the hook. Hypothetically, what do you think the possibilities are that much of our discussion, not all of it, but much of our discussion is moot? In other words, in 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months, Mr. Trump is no longer president, precisely because of, or at least for now, because of the whole Russia conundrum issue, a collusion, whatever you want to call it. You know what, Kim, I think they have something on, nothing recently, but, you know, 10, 15 years ago, some hotel in Switzerland or something like that, some pictures with some, Secret Service agents, women from Russia. I think they got something. I can't find any other possible explanation for why he's being so... Now, and continuing to be so nice, even now, even in the context of everything that's going on in Congress and in the FBI with Comey yesterday, do you think this is going to bring him down?
I don't think that this is going to bring him down. I think that there has to be an explanation for how it is that a sitting president of the United States has relentlessly refused to criticize either the Russian Federation more generally, Vladimir Putin specifically, the seizure of Crimea by the Russian Federation, the threats by the Russian Federation against both Ukraine and other states in Eastern Europe. There's got to be something that explains why, when a president of the United States it's suggested to him that Vladimir Putin basically has eliminated or on his orders eliminated opponents, that the president of the United States' response is something like,
"We
what?
Do it too."
You think that we're so innocent?
Right.
That kind of sort of Chomsky-esque moral equivalency is so bizarre. It is so unprecedented. It is so weird that
they have pictures. They have. Well, I'm telling you, they have pictures of him in Switzerland.
Well, I actually think that there's something different going on, and that is, I think that if he were like every other candidate for president in the last 40 years and had released all of his tax returns in full, not just his 1040s. But his full tax returns, I think that the answer lies in those tax returns, and that's the reason. Why?
Do you think this will bring him down? I mean, this is going to come out eventually. They can subpoena his taxes.
Yeah, I mean, look, let's put it this way: the other puzzle, which isn't actually so much of a puzzle, is why the members of the Republican Party are pretending that Mr. Trump isn't the kind of unhinged president that he clearly is. And that is because the Republicans know that they have a sort of a once-in-a-generation opportunity to get their particular agenda through. Mm-hmm. And they can do that with Trump in the White House. Now, I mean, the one final thing that I would say is that the premise that this president is not going to last 4 years is quite correct. However, I think that what he has launched with his America First economic nationalist, xenophobic, isolationist perspective, that will not necessarily go away if he leaves the White House. I think that his successors, Vice President Pence, will be inclined to understand that there's some political hay to be made from pressing Trump's economic nationalist perspective. So I think even if Trump is either removed via the 25th Amendment or impeached, or even if, you know, I mean, he's a 70-year-old in not very good shape, even if something like an illness strikes him down, mm-hmm. I don't think that his particular agenda or the Trump effect is necessarily going to sort of disappear in a flash, and we're kind of back to the good old days.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm a bit more optimistic than you. I think the fact that Pence is a free trader at heart, I think, the fact that, I mean, his domestic policies is a problem for Americans, not so much for Canadians.
Foreigners.
And for Canadians.
Yeah, exactly.
And Mexico.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, yeah.
So they don't like him for that reason. But as far as foreign policy, you know, he's strong. I think he supports NATO strongly. I don't think, yep, we're going to see the same. I'm more optimistic if Pence and the other thing, of course, he's much more predictable than Trump, and that makes life a lot easier for pretty much everybody in the world.
I agree with you. The one little bit in here is that yes, Mr. Pence is a free trader, but I think that the Republicans in Congress and Mr. Pence will recognize the political advantages of pressing some aspects of an America First economic nationalist agenda.
Okay, Kim. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
You know what? I think we should hook up again if that last hypothetical situation actually emerges and a new President Pence starts talking about what to do in North America, specifically NAFTA and other issues.
Well, let me put it this way. It would be in a mood of great happiness if we were to talk again in the post-Trump era.
I love you, Kim.
All righty.
Have a good one. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. See ya.
See ya.